This is a reading of a set of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Bees. Lecture 3 was given in Dornach on December 1st, 1923. Gentlemen, Mr. Müller gave me another issue of the Swiss Apiculture newsletter, in which there is an article about the experience people have had with honey cures. Quote, "Our continuing experiences with honey cures at the Frauenfelder Home for Children in Amden," unquote, by Dr. Paula Emmerich, Wesen, number 3, March 1923. Several passages are read aloud. And then, Dr. Steiner again. "It will be of interest to you to have me add a few comments to this article today. What happened here is that an attempt was made at this home for children to treat with honey those children who were found to be undernourished. According to the article, the children received honey dissolved in moderately warm milk, milk that had not been overheated or brought to a boil, but had remained below the boiling point. Dr. Emmerich has recorded excellent results to prove her success, namely that the number of red blood cells in these children increased in a very extraordinary way. She had, for example, two children who were siblings. The younger child, upon entering the home, had only 53% red corpuscles. Upon this child's release, after the honey cure had been completed, the red corpuscle count had risen to 82%. The older child had a count of 70% to begin with, and 78% when this child was picked up by the parents. The latter child had experienced less of an increase, but at least there was an increase. This child had been given only the milk cure, but the red blood cells had, nevertheless, risen from 70% to 78%. This child had not been so weak to start with, but also did not grow in strength as much as the first child did. She also lists quite a number of very interesting experiments, and I ask you kindly, when I mention these experiments, to pay attention to the ages of these children. If you want to research the effect that any particular substance might have on human beings, it does no good simply to do these experiments in a laboratory, but rather is necessary to determine, first of all, and immediately, the age of each sick individual, before you conduct any experiments with nutrition or make any attempts to effect a cure. See Table 5, a column of numbers, page 163. We have here the case of an 11-year-old boy. He underwent a honey cure of 8 weeks, and as a result, achieved a very significant improvement in the condition of his glands. His bronchitis diminished, and the red corpuscles, the important constituents of blood, rose in number from 73% to 75%. See upper right. A second example is another 11-year-old who experienced an increase from 55% to 74%. Then there is a 14-year-old girl whose count improved from 70% to 88%. I won't read to you all of the rest of the numbers, but they are, in every instance, significant. Dr. Emmerich also lists the gains in body weight. They, too, give evidence that the children have become stronger. She also lists 3 girls, 1 aged 7 and 2 aged 10, and 6 boys, aged 7, 8, 9, 11, 12, and 13, respectively. These experiments demonstrate that children in this range of ages, specifically of school age, seem to derive the best benefit from this honey cure. In addition to these results, the author of this article tried to determine why it is that these children benefited so much from this honey cure. What she states is remarkably interesting. She indicates something that condemns, in the most extreme way, that which is still applied in many areas by contemporary science. What do the foremost scientists do when they want to assess the nutritive value of certain foods? They do a chemical analysis of these foods in order to determine the type and quantity of chemical substances they contain. That's what today's scientists do. This is what happened. A student, Dr. Emmerich says, of the famous professor of physiology, Bunge, B-U-N-G-E, whom you all know by name at least, was in Basel and conducted experiments that involved feeding mice milk. Footnote, Gustav von Bunge, 1844-1920, a German physiologist of Russian origin. He was a professor in Basel after 1885 and supported the modern notion of neo-vitalism, a renewal of the theory or doctrine that life processes arise from or contain a non-material vital principle and cannot be explained entirely as physical and chemical phenomena. His main works are titled A Handbook of Physiological and Pathological Chemistry, 1887, and titled A Handbook of Human Physiology, 1901, two volumes. End of footnote. These mice had a good life. Their physical condition improved tremendously because they were being fed milk. Then he introduced another element into this experiment. He told himself that milk consists of casein, which is the basis of cheese, fat, sugar, and various salts. He said to himself that mice thrive when they are given milk, and milk consists of casein, fat, sugar, and salts. See Table 5. Hence, he decided to give a similar group of mice these constituents of milk, which are the same as those found in milk. But the mice to whom he gave casein, fat, sugar, and salts died only a few days later. This group of mice had received exactly the same substances, scientifically analyzed, as the first group, but they died. You see, it doesn't make any difference if you know all the parts of a compound. Something else must be involved here. That's what these gentlemen should have told themselves. But what is it they did tell themselves? The gentlemen said that the substances that can be analyzed chemically are all that there can be. These substances are present everywhere. Wherever something happens, a substance must be involved. But those substances contained in milk, casein, fat, sugar, and salts, are not responsible for the results in this experiment. Then the gentleman said that there simply must be another new substance in such immeasurably small quantities that chemical analysis does not uncover it. This substance people now call a vitamin. Vita is the Latin word for life. Hence, vitamin means makes life. See Table 5. Heine once had in mind to ridicule something. Footnote, Heinrich Heine, poet, 1797-1856, his statement that, quote, poverty comes from pauperism, unquote, could not be documented. A very similar statement can be found in Fritz Reuter's title Out of My Stormy Time, chapter 38. Inspector Bresig says, quote, the great poverty in the city comes from the pauperism. End of footnote. He said that there are people who, for example, would like to explain where poverty comes from, what the cause of poverty is. Well, the simplest explanation is that poverty comes from pauperism. Aside pauvreté, the French origin of the English word pauper, the Latin origin. Let me read that again. Aside pauvreté, roughly, P-A-U-V-R-E-T-E, the French origin of the English word, and then semicolon pauper, the Latin origin. End of aside. There are very different words. There you have different words, but they don't really explain anything at all. I was once in literary society, where the discussion turned to the subject of where the comical element came from. A number of people present had given this serious thought and came up with some thought-provoking arguments. But then one of them stood up and walked to the podium in such a way that we all knew instinctively that he had much to say about this subject. He expressed his opinion in this way. The comical element simply comes from the fact that a person has the vis comica, or the power of being comical. See Table 5. That would be the same as if an economist were to ask where money comes from and reply that it comes from the power of making money. By saying this, you haven't explained anything at all. Scholars and experts in the field of economics would immediately think that you were rather strange if you said that the origin of money can be found in the power that creates money. But scientists in the field of natural sciences don't notice anything wrong when someone asks where the enlivening power in milk comes from, and is given the answer, from vitamins. But that's just like saying that poverty comes from pauperism, and nobody notices anything wrong. They even think that this person has said something very profound and true, but in reality nothing of significance has been said. This is what is so upsetting, if I may say so, about the way things are conducted in modern-day science. These scientists think they are saying something truly important. They announce their results using big words, and all the rest of the people believe everything they say. If this type of thing continues in the course of history, the time will come when everything will have to wither and die, for the world is dependent on your ability to actually do something, and not only talk about things and create new abstract terms. Words must mean exactly what is really there. Long ago, there used to be a kind of science that was directly connected to the actual experience of those things under examination. Today we have a science that knows nothing anymore of this direct experience. All it does is think up fantastic new word combinations. And this is only possible because a new authority has been added to the old one. You must also consider how recent the proliferation of scientific journals in specialty areas is. There used to be very few such journals. Reports are printed in these journals on experiments involving beekeeping after the beekeepers have met at one of their conferences. This was still so at the time when I was young. Then, after a conference, you could still learn how things were. One beekeeper would relate his experiences to another, and you could immediately tell if someone was a windbag or if the person had real experiences to back up the statements. It's a very different matter when you hear a person speak. You can tell if the person is speaking about something he or she knows or is only repeating things heard from others. What has been added to this method is the new authority of having something appear in print. When something is printed, people immediately think there must be something to it, because a printed page lends an air of authority to whatever is being conveyed. In this article we are talking about, there is an additional element. This doctor has actually bestowed a blessing by conducting her honey cures. In relating these research results, she has accomplished something truly excellent. And now she starts to think about these results as a modern scientist would, and she comes up empty-handed. She even says so. Quote, "It would be desirable to have the results of our experiments publicized far and wide, and particularly to ensure that our young people will once again eat more honey. For the present, our report includes only the results of our practical experiences, but we don't doubt that as more knowledge about vitamins is obtained, pharmacologists and physiologists will need to devote attention to the problem concerning the effect of honey upon the entire human organism." End quote. Likewise, the author of this article states at the very beginning, quote, "I feel called on at some point to give a doctor's perspective regarding the effects of the honey cure. Our successful results encourage me to try to uncover the deeper relationships and conditions that must exist. Although I am certainly conscious of the fact that I haven't even scratched the surface, I would nevertheless like to indicate, based on our experiences and the results of our experiments, the points from which, in my opinion, future research could continue." End quote. Well, from her words, it becomes clear that this doctor has sufficient modesty to say that using all we know today about vitamins, there is no way to get to the core of this matter. Now, here is something you'll want to consider carefully. We'll try to determine the basis for the effects caused by the honey cures. These experiments do show us something. They show us that the effect of honey is particularly strong. The experiments will continue to demonstrate this more and more, not in very young children, but rather in those children undergoing second dentition, or in those who have definitely already replaced their baby teeth with an adult set of teeth. It is very important to consider this point, which the results clearly demonstrate. But the results also show that honey has its best effect in children if you dissolve it in moderately hot milk. It is this combination of honey and milk that has a strong effect in children. If you continue thinking along these lines, you'll find something else to be true. Honey can begin to have a significant effect upon still younger children. But it is important to use a small amount of honey, more milk, but less honey. In older people, it is primarily the honey that helps, not the milk. You can obtain favorable results in very old people by allowing them to ingest honey without any milk at all. Based upon the experiments recorded here as the results of experiments, based upon the experiences recorded here as the results of experiments, you would have to come to the conclusion that milk and honey play an extraordinarily significant role in the life of a human being. And gentlemen, as I've told you before, the older forms of science weren't as primitive and stupid as present-day science would have you believe. These older forms of science often expressed things in a simplistic way, but they were in reality very wise in their insights. And you know that the old phrase, quote, "This is a country where milk and honey flow," unquote, simply means that it is a healthy country, a country where you can live a healthy life. The people of antiquity knew that both milk and honey are strongly connected with a healthy human life force. Nature sometimes talks to us in a very understandable manner. You will notice what it says if you can take the simple things simply enough. Whoever knows that nature works in very wise ways will not need much proof to determine that milk is something that is good for little children and those who are growing up in adulthood. Otherwise, nature would have seen to it that honey and not milk would flow from a woman's breast. This is something that is not out of the realm of possibility, because plants produce honey. It would indeed be possible for the mammary glands of women to produce honey. You simply have to take things on a simple basis. You should not say that nature is a bungler, constantly botching things, but rather say to yourself that behind all of it lies a fact you can recognize, that milk nourishment is the primary concern for a small child, but as the child grows, you can add more and more of the honey nourishment. We really shouldn't get such an idea in our minds, an idea of the abstract word definition type, and then say to ourselves that poverty comes from pauperism, the comical element from the comic force, and the enlivening force of honey from a vitamin contained in it. On the contrary, we should direct our attention to the reality in these relationships. And in this regard, I'm going to tell you this. We'll put together some ideas we've already encountered in these lectures, but it will be important for you to be able to look at these things with the proper and correct perspective. You see, gentlemen, when you go up into the highest parts of the Alps, where these high mountains are the hardest, where in a sense the hardest parts of the earth extrude upward, right there you'll find quartz crystals. They are very beautiful. In general, you will find all sorts of crystals there. Remember how I sketched these quartz crystals for you? They look like this. See drawing also, table 5. When they are complete crystals, they will look as if they are closed off below, just as they are on top. But most of the time they are not complete. They come out of the surrounding rocky material. They seem to grow out of the rock in the way I've already frequently sketched for you. What does this mean? This means that the earth lets such crystals grow out of itself, crystals that are six-sided and terminate in a point. So within the earth is a power that can shape something like this so that it will have six sides. As I've always explained to you, in human beings reside all the forces that are in the earth, as well as in the cosmos. The earth in turn receives this force from the cosmos. Human beings get it from the earth. The force with which the earth presses out this quartz crystal is contained in a human being. How is it possible that this power is in use, is in us? Well, it's true that the human body is full of quartz. Now, you'll probably say, that man must really be crazy. Listen to that strange rubbish he's telling us. The quartz you find up there in the mountains is truly a hard substance. You can crack a human skull with it, and nothing happens to the quartz crystal. its rigidity is one of its most prominent features. But substances do not always have the same form that they present to us here and there. In human beings exists this very same substance that the quartz crystal is made of, but it takes a more fluid form. Table 6, page 164. Why? You see, it's possible to observe, you simply have to observe properly through a spiritual eye, EYE, directed inwardly, how there is a constant stream of something from the head into the members of the human body. It is interesting how the same substance the earth let stream out of itself became hard, took on the form of a quartz crystal, can now be seen constantly flowing downward from the human head. With the earth it is found streaming out from the earth's interior, and with human beings it streams from the head to the rest of the body. It is either quartz or silicic acid. The only difference is that the human body doesn't allow the quartz to become crystallized. That would really be something. If we were inwardly completely filled with quartz crystals, that would really hurt. The human body allows the quartz substance to develop up to the point where quartz wants to take on its six-sided shape, and then it stops the process at that very point. The body simply doesn't let it happen. Our life as human beings is dependent on the fact that we continuously want to form six-sided crystals, beginning with the head and going down into the rest of the body. But we stop this crystal formation just in time, so that it doesn't happen. As a result, we have what we might call a very thin solution of quartz, quote-unquote, fluid in us. If we didn't have this quartz substance in us, we would, for instance, never have a sweet taste in our mouths, no matter how much sugar we ate. The quartz we have in us is responsible for this, not because of its chemical composition, but rather by virtue of the fact that it has a strong will to take on a six-sided form as a crystal. This is what does it. Everything depends on our understanding this properly. So you see, in the earth we find the same substance, only further developed. The human being stops the process at the point of the development of silicic acid, just when this process wants to become spiky. The earth allows this process to continue until the sharp-pointed nature of quartz pokes its way through to the surface. But the human being needs and uses this power, this silicic acid power, which is the power to produce these six-sided shapes. I can imagine that not all of you were good in geometry. Not all of you will have geometry fresh in your minds. You might not immediately be able to sketch a quartz crystal or model it in clay. But your body is a good geometrician. It wants continuously to make such crystals, but we are held back from doing so. All life consists in stopping the process of dying, and when we no longer are able to stop it, then we simply experience the actual death we've been trying to avoid. Now let's look at a bee again. The bee flies out and collects honey nectar. In its own body, it transforms this honey nectar into honey and creates from it its own powers of life. But it also produces wax. What does it do with this wax? It makes six-sided cells from it. You see, the earth makes six-sided silicic acid crystals, while the bee makes six-sided cells. This is terribly interesting. If I were to sketch for you these cells, or if you can remember how Mr. Müller showed them to you, then you will see that they look like quartz crystals, the only difference being that they are hollow. The quartz crystal is not. But in their form they are completely alike. Table 6, upper right. You see, gentlemen, these cells are hollow. But what goes in there? The egg of the bee is placed into it. Where the silicic acid is contained in the quartz, it is hollow in the cell. That's where a bee egg is placed. The bee is formed by the same force that resides in the earth and can construct a quartz crystal. It's the finely distributed silicic acid that has this effect. There is a force in it that can't be proved using physical methods. In this process, the honey, having been worked upon by the bee's body, has such an effect that it can create wax in just such a form that human beings can use, because all human beings need to have these six-sided spaces within themselves. Human beings need the same things bees do. And since the bee is that creature that can best of all create this force of having a six-sided effect on other things, the bee collects from everything available in nature the very form of nourishment that can carry over into our bodies this same hexagonally acting force, a force that produces a six-sided effect. You see, gentlemen, if you eat honey, you will take into yourselves a tremendously strengthening force. If you have become too weak to develop within yourselves this six-sided force that must flow from your head to the rest of the body, if you don't have any longer the power to give your blood a certain degree of solidity so that this six-sided force is continually present, then honey must step in to make up for the loss. Or, in the case of children, milk will be necessary. Children don't have this six-sided force as yet. They still must obtain it through that which a woman produces in herself in the form of milk. This is why no matter how much casein, fat, sugar, and salt you give mice to eat, they will still die. Why? Because this animal also needs this force to produce the six-sided effect. Just mixing casein, fat, sugar, and salt is not going to yield real milk, because the power that expresses itself in six-sidedness is not there. If you give real milk to mice, this force is imparted. However, it is not contained in milk to such a degree that when the milk turns sour, it will form six-sided crystals. If this hexagonally acting force were just a bit stronger in the milk, then you would be able to drink sour milk that would create tiny silicic acid crystals on your tongue. It would feel as if there were tiny hairs present in the milk. But in milk, the crystallization process doesn't ever reach this point, because the milk originates in a human or animal body, where it remains fluid. For a child, the power contained in milk is sufficient, but not for an adult human being. This maturation toward adulthood, however, begins in childhood. At that time, you need to begin adding the stronger six-sided activating force that is contained in honey. Another interesting point is this. Milk, even if it comes from a human being, is in reality animal-like in nature. It comes from the animal part of a human being. Thus, in the human being, milk is animal. Honey, on the other hand, comes from the plant kingdom via a detour through the bee. Originating in the plant kingdom, it is considered vegetable. Silicic acid, let's say quartz, is mineral. It has a distinct hexagonal shape. The wax, which comes about within the bee, as it is influenced by the bee's metabolism, takes on its form. The wax isn't derived directly from the bee's nourishment, but it receives its form from it, and is shaped into a six-sided cell. Milk dissolves this shape or form quickly, and allows only a shadowy image of six-sided crystals to be formed. Table 6, lower right. As a result, you can say that honey is that form of nutrition that must have the most salutary and beneficial effects on a human being. I suppose you could also reason that it would be a good thing for human beings to substitute salicylic acid for honey, because the salicylic acid would also supply a method for getting this six-sided power into your system. But salicylic acid has an effect on human beings that is too strong, because it was pushed too far along in the process of attaining a six-sided shape and forming the typical salicylic acid shape within itself. Nevertheless, it has some beneficial effects for the human being. Now assume the following circumstance. Imagine a poor child isn't lucky and doesn't receive a honey cure of the type described in the article at the age of 16 or 17 or even of 13 or 14 when it is best. This child doesn't fare well. The percentage of red corpuscles in the blood is reduced more and more as time progresses. The child grows older, and at the age of 30, let's say, lives in poverty, and it has become a very weak human being. The writer of the article even says as much when she says, quote, they simply collapse, unquote. But now you have before you a person who is 30 years old. You could easily initiate a honey cure, but this person has become too enervated, too emaciated. In order to help such a person, you would have to give so much honey that the stomach would be spoiled in the process, for honey is something that demands moderation from the human being who eats it. If you eat too much honey, you will upset your stomach. This is based on a very simple fact. Honey is sweet and contains a lot of sugar. Your stomach, however, needs primarily an acidic content. So, when you ingest too many sweet things, you will spoil the acidic effect the stomach is trying to produce. If you gave such an emaciated person, who is 30 years old, as much honey as such a person would need in order to bring about a positive outcome, he or she would at first suffer from indigestion, which would lead eventually to a chronic intestinal condition. You simply can't do it. You could try something else. You could, to begin with, give such a person as a medication a drastically diluted solution containing powdered quartz, which is salicylic acid. If you give someone this extremely thin solution of salicylic acid as a remedy, this person will, after a certain amount of time has passed, regain the capability of absorbing the beneficial effects of small quantities of honey. This very thinly dissolved salicylic acid will have stimulated within the person the power to make use of the hexagonal force. In this way, you can use a lesser amount of honey as a follow-up. So the salicylic acid can, in a sense, prepare the way for the honey. You could do something similar with a 30-year-old individual whose hemoglobin content is too low. Add a bit of extremely diluted salicylic acid directly to the honey. This is generally permissible for all adults, whereas with children, it is best to give them a great deal of milk. In this way, the honey can have its effect on human beings. You must know how all these things are connected, and then you will be able to ask, quote, what is it, in reality, that brings about the effect that honey can have on human beings? Unquote. It's this hexagonal formative force that works via the honey upon the human being. This power is inside the bee. You can see its effects by observing the bee's wax cells. It is through this power that honey can be of such benefit to humans. For this reason, the statement I made to you earlier is true. In a child, it is primarily the power in milk that is effective, but you can strengthen this power with honey. With adults, for the most part, it is the power in honey that has a strong effect. When a person gets older and has definitely left childhood behind, you will need to strengthen the power in honey with that contained in quartz, as I have described for you. An adult might still derive some benefit from a honey milk cure because the powers of early childhood might still be present. A simple honey cure might also be beneficial. The benefits of a honey cure remain incontestable. Those involved in the practical application of these cures know very well that these beneficial effects exist. What we need to do is make clear to practitioners that they should see to it that the properly measured amounts of honey be available commercially. People generally tend to let themselves be deceived. I don't mean this in the usual criminal sense of the word, but rather I would say that they let themselves be deceived by the general conditions that exist in our culture. If you travel about anywhere and go into hotels where you might ask for some honey, you will frequently receive not honey, but a substitute sugar honey that was produced artificially. If only people knew that such honey isn't the same thing as real honey, that there is no way that this power that produces the hexagonal effect can be present, that they could not have the wool pulled over their eyes, so that they would believe that this artificially made honey has the same effect that genuine honey has. You could naturally feed mice with real honey. They would even enjoy the taste of it. However, if you gave them artificial honey, they would die fairly soon, perhaps even in just a few days. This is what I wanted to say about the article on honey milk cures. Now, there is another interesting matter that has come to my attention. I would like to speak about it, but also to hear from you as to what your thoughts might be about the matter, as well as from Mr. Mueller, who also will speak to you regarding this matter. You'll see that so many questions will come up that we'll have to talk about this again next time. You'll be able then to ask questions, and Mr. Mueller and I will answer them. At this time, I want only to touch upon two things quickly. These may seem rather strange to you, but I'm quite interested in finding out how you will react to them. Now, there's a question submitted in writing, and this is the question. Among the beekeepers in traditional farming communities, there is a conviction that between the beekeeper and the bees, there is a certain soul connection, a spiritual bond that exists between them. So they say that if the beekeeper dies, the death must immediately be made known to the bees. If this is not done, all of the bees will die during the course of the next year. That is, a certain spiritual rapport exists between them is made clear by the experience that many have had. If you try to attend to your bees when you are in an angry mood, the bees will sting you more frequently than if you carry out your tasks with the bees when you are in a calm mood and in harmony with your environment. Is there any basis in reality for this somewhat ancient notion that older beekeepers have? End of question. Dr. Steiner responds. It would be interesting to hear from Mr. Mueller, if he could simply say that such things are a total figment of the imagination. Such things as announcing the death of the beekeeper are customary among beekeepers in the country. But I'm more interested in this spiritual rapport, this relationship between the beekeeper and the bees. Perhaps Mr. Mueller could say something about this. Mr. Mueller then responds, and he talks about two illustrative cases in Basel and Zurich. In one family, the wife, who had helped very much in tending the bees, died, and in the course of 1 year, all of the hives died out. In another case, this one in Basel, it was also a wife who was very much devoted to tending the bees who died. The same thing happened. It was a large apiary. In the course of a year, 28 hives were reduced to only 6. I can't explain how that is connected to the time span and why it happened to those bees. In one case, it was established that the bees did not die of any known disease. Perhaps there was a soul connection. Dr. Steiner responds, let's try to remember what I once told you about the connection between humans and animals. You may have heard me talking about it. I've mentioned it in the past. A while ago, there was much talk about so-called calculating horses, horses that were given a question such as, how much is 4 plus 5? Then the owner of the horse began counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, at which point the horse stamped the ground with its foot. These horses did innumerable calculations like this. You've probably heard that the horses from the Elberfeld region became quite famous in this regard. Investigative commissions were sent there to research this matter and get to the bottom of it. I myself have not seen these horses from Elberfeld, but I saw another such calculating horse that belonged to a Mr. von Osten. This horse also performed this feat. From this example alone, you could draw a conclusion as to the real basis for such a phenomenon. Footnote, see the article by Oscar Fungst, titled Mr. von Osten's Horse, Smart John, A Contribution to Experimental Animal and Human Psychology, Leipzig, 1937, end of footnote. People have really racked their brains to try to figure this one out. When you think about it, there is something terribly shocking about horses that are said to suddenly begin doing calculations. They calculate so well that you could almost dispense with calculating machines. Well, gentlemen, if you could teach horses to do this, the competition between horses on the one hand and bookkeepers and accountants on the other could become fierce. However, the story behind these horses is not a nice one. Even the scientific world suffered an unbelievable degree of embarrassment in probing for the truth in this matter. There is, however, an easy way to get a handle on it. Naturally, a horse can't really do calculations. What you need to find out is why it happens that the horse stamps its foot at the number 9. It would be a case of complete idiocy to contend, or even believe, that a horse is able to do these calculations. Even Professor Pfungst, who studied this matter very carefully, knew this for a fact. But he then established a theory. He said to himself, Mr. von Austen must make a certain kind of face, or have a slightly different expression on his face, and then the horse must see this slightly changed expression on his face. The horse must detect this very slight change in the lines on his face. When seeing this change, the horse stamps its foot. But then this professor states his own objection to this line of thinking. He figures that he should be able to place himself directly before Mr. von Austen and watch his facial expressions very carefully. This he did, but he noticed nothing at all. But he didn't let himself get confused by his own theory. So he said to himself, "This change in expression is so minute that I can't detect it, but the horse can." Well, gentlemen, what we can conclude from this is that a horse can see more and better than a professor. There can be no other conclusion. But this is not the way things are. If you are trained in anthroposophic science, which allows for a spiritual as well as the obvious physical dimension, and you go to examine this matter, then you will not place emphasis upon any slight change in expression. But this is the way things really were. The horse stood on one side, and Mr. von Austen, holding the bridle loosely, stood on the other side. And in the right pocket of his jacket, Mr. von Austen had many small pieces of sugar, which he continually gave to the horse. The more the horse licked and ate these pieces and savored their sweetness, the more it began to love Mr. von Austen. As this love increased, supported each time by the offering of sugar, a very cordial relationship between Mr. von Austen and the horse was formed. Mr. von Austen didn't even need to change his expression ever so slightly. He only needed to think, when I reach 9, the calculation is correct. The horse then senses this thought, because animals have a much finer sensitivity to all those things that are going on in their immediate environment. They sense what is going on in your head, even though you don't express it visually, through a facial expression that a horse might see, but not a human being. The horse senses what is going on in your brain when you are thinking 9, and then stamps its foot. If the horse had not received the sugar, the horse's love might have transformed itself somewhat into hate, and then it would not have stamped its foot. So you see, animals have a very fine sensitivity for things, not for almost imperceptible facial expressions, but rather for truly invisible things, just as Hans the horse had for what was happening in Mr. von Austen's brain. These are things you simply have to observe. Then you will know that animals indeed can feel things in what seems to us a very marvelous way. Just imagine for a moment that you are walking into a swarm of bees and you are extremely afraid. Well, the bees can feel that you have fear. There is no way to deny it. What does it mean that you are afraid? You know that if you are afraid, you will become pale, and when you become pale, your blood is held back. It doesn't flow outwardly into your skin. Now, when a bee approaches a person who is afraid, it senses in that person more than it normally does when the blood is properly distributed in the skin, this force that affects things in a six-sided manner, and it wants to obtain from you honey or wax. Whereas, if a person calmly approaches the bees and the blood is distributed evenly, the bee has a very different experience. The bee then notices that the person's blood has the same amount of the six-sided power as it has. Now imagine that you are angry as you approach the bees. Anger will make you red. In this case, a lot of blood suffuses the skin, and this blood wants to receive more of the six-sided force. The bee with its fine sensitivity, notices this and believes that you want to take away from it this six-sided power, so it stings you. These are very fine sensibilities that register the various powers in nature that are playing about out there or are contained inside things. Add to this the process of becoming accustomed to being in someone's presence. Consider also that a beekeeper doesn't approach a beehive the same way any person, chosen randomly, would walk up to a beehive. The bees feel, if I may use this expression, a person's effluvia, exhalations, vapors, or perspiration. They know what makes up a specific human being and become accustomed to this individual. If this person dies, then they have to break the relationship with one and gradually become accustomed to another. This is of great significance for the bees. Consider what you can find happening with dogs. It has happened before that when the master of a dog died, the dog went to its master's grave and died there, because it couldn't easily get used to a new master. So why can't you assume that bees, known for having a very fine sense of chemical substances, can perceive all these things, that they can become so accustomed to a particular beekeeper that they are unable to do an about-face and immediately accept a new beekeeper? There is something very important upon which all of this is based. But you may say, is the situation with dogs and horses the same as with those tiny creatures, the insects? Well, you may not have observed this, but it is nevertheless true. You can find people who have a green thumb when it comes to growing plants, whether it's potted plants or plants growing outside. Another person puts in at least the same amount of effort. Nothing happens. It's a person's Ausdünstung, exhalations, vapors, perspiration, and so forth, that influences the flowers favorably when it comes from one person, but unfavorably when it comes from another. And for some individuals, growing plants comes completely to nothing. This unfavorable influence is primarily on the force residing in the plant, a force that produces the nectar and that produces sweetness within the plant. So you could say that human beings can affect flowers, but they can affect bees even more strongly. You don't have to be astonished about this at all. Just keep the facts together in their proper relationships. You'll then see that such things can really be true. You'll also be able to consider these matters as you carry out the practical aspects of beekeeping. A second question. There is an old farmer saying that states that if it rains on the 3rd of May, the nectar gets washed out of the blossoms on flowers and trees, so that honey production is reduced that year. My observations during the past 4 years seem to indicate there may be some truth to this adage. Is something like this really possible? Dr. Steiner responds, yes, gentlemen, this is something that will lead us more deeply into the area of the various influences that exist in nature. The fact that it is specifically the 3rd of May is of lesser importance. What is important is the season that is active around this time of year. What does it mean when it rains at this time near the beginning of May? I once told you that the vernal equinox is now located in the constellation Pisces, table 5, upper left. The sun remains in this constellation until approximately April 23rd, at which time it moves into the constellation Aries. At the beginning of May, the sun's rays come from a different part of the sky than they do at other times of the year. Assume, for instance, that the weather is beautiful at the beginning of May, which would include May 3rd. What does this mean? It means that the sun exerts a powerful influence upon all earthly things. All those things that happen here on earth take place under the sun's influence when the weather is beautiful. What then would be the significance of rain on May 3rd or at the beginning of May? It means that the earth's forces are greater and dispel the effects of the sun. All of this is of tremendous importance for the growth of all plants. If the sun's power can allow its influence to be felt at just that point in time when the sun's rays originate from the Aries region of the sky, so that it can bring its full force to bear upon the flowers, then the flowers will develop this sweet substance that appears in the nectar. Then the bees will find this nectar to make honey. If, however, the earth's power can prevail when there is rain at this time, then the flowers can't develop under the sun's rays that come from the Aries region. But they will have to wait for a later sun period. Or they may be interrupted entirely in the development of what they already have. Then the flowers will not properly produce nectar, and the bees will not find any honey. These matters will become clear to you if you know that everything that happens on earth, as I have frequently told you before, is open to the influences emanating from the cosmos, from whatever is located outside the earth and surrounds it in all directions. Rain simply means that the sun's influence is driven away. Beautiful, clear weather means that the sun's power can manifest its full potential in the influences it sends in the direction of the earth. And what is important is not that the sun generally shines in our direction all year long, but rather that the sun's forces are coming from a specific area of the sky, not the area we are looking at now, December 1, but specifically the region known as Aries. From every corner of the sky, the sun's power acts differently. It is not the sun alone that has these effects. Instead, it is important that the background behind the sun is a certain region, such as Aries. That which the Aries region gives to the sun is assimilated by the sun and then passed on in the sun's rays. It's quite a different matter if the sun sends its rays to the earth at the beginning or at the end of May. At the beginning of May, the full power of Aries is still effective, but at the end of May, the power of Taurus makes itself known. At this point, the influence is one that no longer can exert itself on plants in the same way. Its effect is rather one that causes the plants to harden and dry out, and as a result, the plants no longer have the proper power to create nectar. Table 6, middle. So there is, after all, something to these old farmers' sayings. One ought to pay attention to them. Naturally, as I've told you before, the proper understanding of such things has been lost, and for this reason we have become superstitious. This happens when you no longer can distinguish one thing from another. Then these proverbs or adages have about the same value as the one that says, if the rooster crows on the dung heap, either the weather will change or it will remain as it is. But this is not always the case with such sayings. Some of them are based on ancient wisdom, which you will need to delve into. The farmers who followed these sayings sometimes did very well for themselves in adhering to them. You see, a deeper understanding can lead us back to using such sayings, albeit with a new understanding of their significance. We'll continue next Wednesday. The end of Lecture 3.